are live, back with another episode of Shifting the Narrative on Everything Autism. I'm Torin Kearns, and as usual, I'm joined by the autism sage herself, Mama Baden. How are you?
I'm good. I am good. The sun is shining, and I am on location. That sounds fancy, right? On location.
You're like one of those reporters.
I'm on location.
Who stands in the middle of a hurricane.
Doing a home visit, so it's always fun to come and see my students in person. But we have a really good topic, great guest that I think our listeners are going to find very insightful, but also, so just for transparency, I'm gonna ask questions that I know some of my parents would ask, and I know Torin has a different perspective. So I'm thinking in terms of what our parents would be thinking about, mainly because I think a lot of times parents don't look at, after they get an autism diagnosis, they don't look for any learning disabilities. Like, they're just like, done, that's it, like, check, and that's it. And as we're going to talk about, dyslexia is very much, I think it's, I don't want to use the word common. You guys can talk about it, because I think that there are more people with dyslexia than we really think. Like, we don't really talk about it enough. All right, you can take the lead, Torin.
Yeah, I'm sure you have a bunch of questions, and so do I. And I suspect a lot of our questions overlap, though. We like to do these sort of raw and authentic. But first off, Lynn, Jonathan, would you like to introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm Lynn Greenberg, and Jonathan and I co-wrote a children's book. And he did all the illustrations. And John?
I'm Jonathan Greenberg. With an introduction like that, I guess there's not much more to say.
Except the title of the book.
And the title is indeed Robbie the Dyslexic Daxy.
Oh my gosh, I love it. I love it. I love it. Did you all write the children's book thinking from the perspective of, I wish I would have had this when I was younger? Or is it from the perspective of, we just, like, people just need to know? Like, what was the sort of drive around writing the book?
Well, for me, definitely, because I would have loved to have had a book like this when I was younger. Well, I couldn't read, and I was the one with dyslexia here, out of the two of us. And if I hadn't had that, Mom would do the reading of children's books to me. So I would have loved to have had heard something like this.
Yeah.
But I think for Mom, the reason that, and also, tell me if I'm wrong here, but that you wanted to spread word about it. Am I incorrect?
John and I, you know, thought when you go into a bookstore, there really are not a lot of books with neurodivergent characters. And we thought, this is a market that really is underserved. It's underserved for the community, you know, someone with dyslexia or autism or ADHD. There just really aren't a lot of children's books that will where somebody can see themselves. But also, I think teachers and parents and caregivers and children, people who aren't dyslexic, need to know a little bit more and see that it's a community that's wonderful and thriving. And, you know, I think people need to acknowledge that everyone is a little different. And I think books need to come in all shapes and sizes for all people in different shapes and sizes. So
I agree.
That's really, we wanted to deal with both of those issues.
You know, it's one of those things where I think about when all the schools are talking about inclusion, inclusion, inclusion. And I'm like, well, inclusion is great, but you also, like, the other kids need to know, like, what is dyslexia, right? Like, why does Bobby spin, right? Like, why does whomever wear hearing aids? Because we just assume that kids are, oh, okay, which they usually are. But I think that if we explain it, like, in a book, in a children's book, especially things like the myth of, people really think dyslexia is only seeing letters backwards. Like, that's all people think about. And so having something where kids can read and parents can read and understand, it gives another perspective. So I'm excited that it's available. And
thanks. You know, it was interesting because last year I went to he was then in first grade, my oldest grandchild, and I read to his class. And, you know, in first grade, a lot of kids are starting to learn. Mm-hmm. And so there was an interesting conversation with them. You know, what does it mean to be dyslexic? What does it mean, you know, if you can't say the ABCs? Mm-hmm. And it opened up a conversation, I think, for some of the children who actually were struggling to learn their ABCs. But for those kids who were learning them and doing okay and, you know, learning whatever normal is, but normally, I think it opened up a conversation for everybody. And I think it's something that we were happy to see, because that's really what we wanted. We wanted to open conversations and have people be seen.
That's right. Important.
And I think, and Stacy brought up something real quick that was sort of important to me. And I think both Stacy and Lynn brought this up. There's sort of a just narrow understanding of a lot of different sort of neurodiversities, but in the context of dyslexia, there's all I knew about dyslexia growing up is like you see letters backwards. And so that's why I didn't realize I was dyslexic till like last year, a few months ago. It was sort of a gradual process for me because I didn't see the letters backwards. I just struggled with reading. I would see words that weren't there. Sometimes I'd see words in different orders than they were supposed to be, or I'd just read something and it just wouldn't, I call it stick. It wouldn't stick in my brain and I'd have to read something 3 or 4 times. And I had other issues like struggles with summarizing stories in school. You expect to read a story, you're supposed to be able to verbally summarize it. And I just couldn't, which of course would lead to an autistic meltdown because they'd be like, why can't you? I couldn't spell. A story I tell on the podcast is I work with kids for a while as a teacher. And I work with like first and second graders in South Bronx public schools. So these kids are not at grade level. And they would routinely have to correct me on my spelling. Like, it happened all the time. The running joke was Mr. Torin can't spell. So these kids who were below grade level at first and second grade in underfunded public schools had a higher level of spelling than I did, because I words just are not good with me. So I didn't think anything of it. I used to make a joke. I was a creative writing major in college. I would make a joke even back then. I'm the only creative writing major that can't read. So I think it's really important that you're helping to provide this understanding, not just for other people, but for like adults, because a lot of adults don't get diagnosed, especially if you're in like underfunded environments, underprivileged environments, like where I come from. You don't get that sort of testing, or it's very hard to access. So I think it's very important that you are doing that. I just wanted to say that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It is super, super important. So I have a question that may have nothing to do with the book, but it's a question that is sort of burning my brain. So I am a firm believer, as a speech therapist, as someone who works with people who have different learning styles, I think technology is wonderful. We have access to technology. I always say, sort of in a joking way, like, you know, to have any kind of disability, this is a great time, right? Because there's so many technology. I mean, visually impaired people have apps to help them get dressed independently. They don't have to have someone color match for them. There's so many things. So my question is, how do you feel, or what are your thoughts on, I am a believer of what are the supports a child needs, right? So if you're struggling with reading because of dyslexia, then I feel like an audiobook is fine for certain things or whatever it is, right? Like, just get some support in there, right? Get an audiobook. What are your thoughts? And because I don't have the personal experience of being dyslexic myself, but I do think that a lot of people who listen to audiobooks are probably listening to them for a reason as adults. So what are your thoughts on that in terms of, I'm not saying children should not learn to read. I'm saying, what are your thoughts on having that support within the school of them being able to listen through their computer to a passage instead of having to muddle through because of whatever reason? I'm not, you know, yes, you can get extended time, but that doesn't always help, right? You're just reading the same thing over and over again. Or maybe auditorily, it doesn't make a difference. I'm going to stop right there and let you guys respond.
I feel that audiobooks and the like definitely have a place. I think they're important and can definitely be used as such. But I do think it is also still important to try to teach to read and write, because not only is it important for overall, you know, day-to-day experiences, but it helps you learn new teaching abilities and really helps for the future. It gives you like strategies almost. I had to learn them for how I read and write, and I can use those strategies while they were originally intended for just reading and writing for other things as well. So I think that's important.
When John was little, before he learned how to read, we used to listen to audiobooks all the time. It was interesting because we would stop, you know, I would stop the book sometimes and we would talk about it, or we'd ask questions, or what do you think about this? So for him, as he, you know, was struggling, and then as he was learning how to read, I think it was an important part, an important component of his education. And I think it really helped him start thinking about the written word and the spoken word, and just how to use both. But as John said, I think, you know, fortunately and unfortunately, there's so much technology, but I also think it's important to go old school sometimes, and try to, and to the best of anyone's ability, to learn how to read and write. You know, I think unfortunately, though, the way our school system is, that we just don't have the ability to give even the learning specialist enough of the of what they need to teach. And, you know, there's so many kids, and there's so many, you know, headings under a neurodivergent, a learning specialist, that they can't possibly learn how to teach every kind of neurodiversity, any issue. And when John was younger, the learning specialist said to me quietly, "I can't help John. You're going to have to find other strategies for him." And I think, unfortunately, you know, people don't always have the ability to teach our children. So we definitely need to learn and to use some of these other strategies. But I think it's also, as John said, important to try to give the basics as best as we can to children who are dyslexic.
That makes a lot of sense. And the unfortunate part in the school system, and I've never understood it, and I've had several different roles in the school system, never understood why dyslexia does not qualify as a specific learning disability for an IEP. Why do we not have trained people in our schools to know how to teach our students? I mean, I had to take training on my own for my own students. It was not anything that was given or provided by the school system. And most of our kids with dyslexia were just pushed to the side because I don't understand why dyslexia, I will never understand why it doesn't fall under Bulletin 1506. I mean, it just blows my mind that students with dyslexia have to fight even harder than autism to get services and support. It just blows my mind. It's not a nuance. It's not something new. Like,
well, I think there's been so many there's been so much conversation about different neurodiversities, but I think autism has in recent years had quite a bit of conversation, because there have been more and more platforms, autism awareness, that puzzle piece. You know, there are different people at least know the word more, whether or not they know how to address it or see it or talk about it or who might have it. And dyslexia only recently has become more of a conversation. I think, you know, the numbers are crazy. Over half the people in our criminals, you know, in our jails have dyslexia, and it's because they couldn't read and write and they had to find other ways to be self-sustaining, or they felt badly about themselves and, you know, didn't take a path that was most beneficial to them. And now there's been more and more conversation, including Mayor Adams in New York wanting to help teach teachers how to teach people with dyslexia. But I think that there needs to be more awareness, and there just isn't. Even as you said, the school system in general is just not really up to speed on where it needs to be for teaching a lot of these issues.
I feel like a big issue, and you're completely right, that's just sort of my sense as sort of an outsider looking in, where I feel like dyslexia has sort of been almost like a straight line. Like the awareness existed, like I'm about to turn 32. The awareness that existed when I was 8 is more or less the awareness that's still there nowadays. I feel like it hasn't grown all that much, as opposed to something like autism, where there's still a lot of work to be done. There is starting to be more awareness. I think, like you mentioned, I'm glad you brought up the prison thing, because I was going to bring it up, where I thought the number was 30%. It's 50. It's even higher, I guess, which is upsetting.
It's
my mistake. And that strikes me, because like where I come from, a lot of kids, like no one gets diagnosed. That's no one I grew up with gets diagnosed dyslexia. No, like you don't even get diagnosed things like autism unless it's like you have like your support needs are so high that they can't ignore it. If they can ignore it, which unfortunately with dyslexia, you kind of can for the most part. If you can ignore it, they just do. And then what happens is you don't do well in school. And especially when you come from underprivileged backgrounds, that's like being either super athletic or have really good grades. That's the only way, or join the military. That's pretty much the only way you're getting. So a lot of these people end up in the criminal justice system is you don't have a route, because unless you're genetically gifted, you're not going to do well in school. If you have undiagnosed learning disability, it's going to be much tougher. You're kind of up the creek.
Yeah, it's you know, listening to you say that, Torin, and sort of going off the lack of awareness, I guess for me, I'm like, I don't understand why nobody's not talking about it. I mean, it's not anything new. Like for me, I'm just like, I don't understand why. I've never understood, but I still just don't understand why it's not at the forefront, because there's people on
television. Because it can be ignored, that's why. Because it can be ignored.
Well, I think it also has to do with, it requires work and money put into the school system. It requires training. It requires them to do something different. And when we think of generational, for lack of a better term, illiteracy, like I have parents who can't read, right? They just come to IEP and say, I don't know how to read. And I'm thinking they're probably have a learning disability, and no one even looked their way. And like you said, they are just sort of like ignored. And I always think about this little boy who told me once when I asked him, I said, what is like, why are you like, why are you throwing chairs and acting like this in class? Like, you know, it was just like, okay, I didn't get it, right? It wasn't one of those situations where I could pinpoint it. And he looked at me and he said, I can't read, and it's better to be the bad kid or the funny kid than the stupid kid. And I said, yep. I got it, right? And so then of course we were able to dig a little bit more into it, but that leads to that prison, right? Where you're either going to be a comedian and be the dyslexic comedian that talks about, you know, I was dyslexic. Was it? Oh my gosh, I just saw her the other day. She's on The View. She talks about it all the time. Oh my gosh,
Whoopi Goldberg, yes.
Yeah. She always talks about her dyslexia.
So many people, entertainers and creative people who are dyslexic. It's the numbers are very high.
Yes.
Example is Henry Winkler. He did a lot of stuff like that and is well known in his many fields.
Yeah.
I think Howie Mandel might be dyslexic too.
He's got a whole potpourri of neurodivergent. He's got the big bundle.
The big bundle.
He has a lot of comorbidities, but a lot of people do. You know, it's very interesting. I would say, of all the people John knows now, I would say who are dyslexic, half of them at least have ADHD also. You know, some have problems like with writing, like dysgraphia, dyscalculia. A lot of them definitely have trouble with with numbers. But I think also it's really important is to say that, you know, dyslexia can be a superpower. John's superpower is his art. I mean, the book, you know, is amazing. The illustrations, I know I'm a proud mom, but the illustrations are amazing. And that's, so that's his superpower. He's always been able to speak through his art. And, you know, that's why Robbie the Dyslexic Taxi and the Airport Adventure has been so appealing to so many people, because the characters are really, they're really cute. And the colors are bright, and it just speaks to a lot of people.
So my next question, I'm so sorry, Torin, I said I was going to let you talk. What was, because I'm so curious about like the process of children's books, right? Because people think, oh, it's children's book, they're so easy. It's like, no, they're really, really hard. Like to do a good children's book is not simple. Yeah, so what, how did you guys come up with the characters and like, just share with our listeners? Because I will say I do have few moms that listen who would one day like to do a children's book, and I always think it's nice to hear, but I'm just curious because people who create things is fascinating to me, right? Like all the books have not been written. So how did you come up with the characters and just sort of like the theme? Was it drawing first and it came to you, or was there a different process?
Well, for the design point of view, for the names, a lot of them are named off family and friends. And more of like inside jokes, I guess you could say, like the fact that one character would be working, would be in ambulance, and it's based on someone in the family who's adopted, that sort of stuff.
Gotcha.
But on a more why taxis and, you know, cars, well, that idea came from something, my dad actually mentioned about. One problem for me I used to have being dyslexic is I had a hard time telling my lefts from my rights. And there are times when I could easily get lost, including in what many would say is the most easy to navigate city, New York City, where I got completely lost. And I did manage to make my way to where I needed to be, but because of that, it was, you know, sort of a funny story to tell. And so he mentioned, well, what would a taxi do? And me and mom just sort of latched onto that idea, and we were like, yeah, no, a taxi would have to come up with some very intriguing ways to get around this. And that's how Robbie was born.
Wait. Do you not be able to tell your left and right dyslexic thing?
I don't know exactly if it's a dyslexic thing.
I thought that was just me. Like, what I have to do is, if I knew my left and my right, I have to hold my hands up like this. And obviously the left side, if you put your pointer and your thumb, it creates an L, and that's the left, and obviously the opposite's your right. So when I'm navigating, I have to put my hands up like I'm doing a field goal in paper football, just so I know which way to go. That's always how I do it, because I can't tell my left and my right.
That's what I was taught, actually.
Yes, so you see what I mean?
Yes.
That was just something I had to deal with. And by the way, Stacy, don't worry about cutting me off, because I was going to ask literally the exact same question.
I can't believe I'm so sorry. I know the listeners can't see you guys, but Torin's like literally holding up. So for you to know to turn left, you have to have a visual to tell you and remind you where left is.
Yes. So if you hold your pointer finger and your thumb and create a shape of an L with both hands and put them in front of you, your left hand is going to create the letter L. So that means that side is left. Obviously the opposite side that makes the backward L's is right. So the part that's the forward L, that's left, opposite's right. So that's how, I was like a teenager by the time someone taught me this. I think it was some teacher who was getting pissed off because we were in line. I could never tell what, I think I was in like fifth grade. We were in line. I just couldn't tell what, he'd say go left, and I'd go right, and go right, I'd go left, because I just didn't know. So he taught me that, and now I still have to do that. Like, I still have to have the visual, if I'm getting lost, of knowing which way is left to right. So I didn't know that. I thought that was just a me thing.
I think it is.
I think even when you said, you know, everyone thinks it's changing the way you see letters backwards and forwards, you know. So even that's not all of what dyslexia is. There is a piece of that. There is a component to it for some people. And so then it definitely feeds into your directional ability.
Interesting. Look at that. I learned something new today, and you did too. I'm going to remember that.
But so the other question I want to ask is, I'm sure you get this question a lot, but I'm asking because it could really help our parents. I also understand this is a long question, very open-ended, but could you tell us, especially Lynn, could you tell us about like Jonathan's sort of dyslexic journey? So when you thought he might be dyslexic, the diagnosis process, maybe some of the pushback you might have had dealing with that, especially because you were an attorney. And so you have a lot of experience dealing with that. So a lot of parents are going through the same thing with all sorts of different neurodivergent issues. So could you just like kind of give us the rundown of like how that went for you?
Sure. John is my youngest of four children, and everyone certainly knows how to, you know, that we all know that people learn differently, but John wasn't following any of the, you know, normal cues. He didn't want to say the ABCs. He could tell me every Thomas the Tank Engine, what their name was, but not that Thomas started with the letter T. And you know, he didn't want to watch Sesame Street. He didn't want to sing the ABC song. He just wasn't following a lot of what, you know, you would think a child who was sort of following a certain educational kind of path. And, you know, his teachers in nursery school would say, nah, he's a boy, he's slow. And I was like, no, he's not. I can tell he's not. You know, he remembers things that I don't remember. And he's a little kid, you know, he was four. And I thought, this is crazy. And as he got older, it kept happening. And I was getting upset because I realized that they were not understanding my child. And, you know, the so-called experts were telling me that he just wasn't that smart. And I was getting angry. And I felt also at that point, you know, it wasn't just the verbal cues, it was nonverbal. He was starting to act out a little bit. He would get up in class and just sort of wander. And I think it's important as parents to realize that children can't always tell you what's wrong. People can't always tell you what's wrong, but they know something doesn't feel right. And it turned out, you know, everyone told me to just let him stay back, you know, repeat a grade. And I thought, this isn't a good answer for me. And I started asking questions of other people outside the school system, a pediatrician, a friend of mine who's a doctor. And I found somebody who could test him. And sure enough, because they didn't want to do it in school. And sure enough, he was classic dyslexic, super, super smart. But, you know, he was dyslexic, couldn't learn to read and write the same way that, you know, a lot of the kids in his class could. And he also had ADHD. And so then it was, you know, such a relief, especially I think for John to know that it wasn't, you know, his fault. Mm-hmm. But then the next part of the journey was how do we remediate this? How can we help John learn how to read? And as I said before, you know, the learning specialist told me point blank, they couldn't do it in school. And his teacher pretty much said to me, you know, well, I don't understand. He can memorize the story. Why can't he read it? And so I knew I wasn't going to get what he needed at school. So I had to look outside of school. And there's a wonderful school in Westchester and now in Manhattan, also called the Windward School, that only teaches children with dyslexia or language-based learning issues. And we made a family decision because it was going to be a drive and it's private school. We made a family decision that John would go there, you know, so I would drive him every day. We ate a lot of peanut butter and jelly. You know, it was a family decision because we felt it was going to be very important and John just was not going to get the help he needed in our community. And that's how his journey went.
Listeners, rewind and listen to that, because I'm always talking to parents about you have to prioritize and shift your priorities. And I love this story of we made a family decision and we ate peanut butter and jelly, right? It's like we decided to shift our priorities on where we were going to spend our money and make Jonathan a priority, his education a priority. And I love that. Like, I love that because I'm not saying that everybody has access, but I don't think that I think people get caught up in, you can't vary from the steps, right? Like everybody does this and everybody does that and you have to do this and we all have to save for this. And it's like, no, you have to do what you have to do when life deals you something and you figure it out the best you can. So thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate that because I think it's hard for parents to do that because everyone else gets backlash, right? Everyone else gives backlash. You have to battle other family members in the community of why you're doing something different that may be more costly than you budgeted or thought about when you had children, but it's what needed to be done. So thank you so much. I just want to say thank you for sharing that story. It's important.
Stacy brings up a good point because I don't plan any of my questions ahead of time. I am curious, Lynn, this for you and the family as a whole. What, how can I say this? What sort of, how do you think you got to the mindset of we just need to do what we have to? Because a lot of parents sometimes will struggle with that, where those sort of get into like the sort of woe is me, like my child has X, Y, and Z issues that's causing all this hardship. I don't want to use the term victim mentality because it's sort of been poison pilled by certain bad actors. But how were you able to avoid that? Or what allowed you not to sink into that sort of woe is us mentality and more into a we just need to do what we have to do mentality?
I think a lot of parents, when they have children, I think they don't see this child as a unique human being. They see this child as an extension of themselves. And, you know, yes, they are. But on the other hand, just because a child is maybe not what you planned, maybe, you know, they're not playing soccer and going to Harvard, and who cares? Your child is amazing and unique, and you have to unlock who that child is, and whether that child has a neurodivergent issue. Maybe they're very artistic and you really are a sporty person and you really want your child to go play tennis. If that child can't go play tennis, don't make them go play tennis. Maybe they'd rather go, you know, draw a picture or read a book. You have to really see your children for who they are and take your own feelings, whatever they might be, out of it. You know, obviously we have to have our children behave, you know, within a certain set of parameters, but I think we really need to see our children as individuals. And I think I had a lot of people say to me, why on earth would you go? Why would you drive 45 minutes to the school? And why would you bother? And why would you pay for it? All the questions that you were, you know, talking about before. But I thought, you know what? You know, if my child needed tutoring in math, I would give it to them. If my child adored tennis and needed a coach, I would get that. I think it's really important, though, to just see your child for who, you know, he, she, they are. And, you know, our children come in all shapes and sizes, and we really need to value their own individuality. And I think that's very important. And I was lucky, and my husband and I are on the same page about that. Not everyone can speak to that. And John's siblings were on the same page. And so, you know, I feel very lucky that as a family, we could come together and make a you know, decision to help John become who John is now, and, you know, the amazing person that he is. So
I love that. And I have a question for Jonathan, but once again, and I don't normally do this twice in a podcast, but listeners, rewind, listen to that part again, because just like you said, parents will do everything for their kid to go to championship soccer and baseball, right? Like they'll all like put their mortgages, second mortgages to like go to the football camp or the ballet or whatever it is.
They'll do that like reverse mortgage thing you see Tom Selleck selling on the TV.
Exactly. So when it comes to education, like that should also be something that families decide, how are we going to look at supporting this family member who right now needs us to do something differently. So I would like to know, Jonathan, from a, if you can, I don't know how old you are. How old are you now, Jonathan? You don't have to say if you don't say.
I am going to be turning 25 in May.
Oh, well, you still have your memory. Okay. So when you, when you were younger, can you share What was it like when you were in the environment where they did not understand what you needed compared to going to a school that had what you needed so that you could become a reading could be there, but also a little bit easier, I assume?
It was very disheartening because, not knowing why I couldn't read and write, being called, sort of disparaging names and not having any sort of connection with anyone was really isolating. And I would not wish that upon anyone. But at the same time, it did get me to this place that I'm at now where I'm getting an MFA and working in the arts. And so I don't regret that. But when I found out, it was fairly, as Mom mentioned earlier, I came to the form of relief because I knew it wasn't just me, there was a reason for it. And when I went to a program like Inward, which was more specialized, and I saw so many other people with the same, situation as me, once again, I just felt really relieved. And there was still a lot of work that needed to be done. I had to learn a lot of strategies. There was the Morgan Gillingham method, which was what the school taught. And so there was still work to be done, yes, but I now knew what I was doing and I was on the right path, and that was the most important part. And I even went back recently to read the book to some students at Winward, and they were all very, just seeing everyone so happy about it and seeing faces that I would have loved to have seen when I was their age really is something I will never forget.
And Jonathan, two quick questions. First is, so the Winward School, is that K through 12, or how long were you there for?
It is K through 12. They don't really have
it's first through ninth. Now it used to be K through 12, right?
My bad.
No, it used to be way back in the day, but they found that most kids fit into sort of the middle numbers. So there's a teeny first grade and a teeny ninth grade, but it's just first through ninth.
That makes sense. So when you were there, especially as you were becoming a teenager, because I was in special ed from different special ed schools, but from preschool through 12th grade. And especially as I became a teenager and started hitting puberty, me and the rest of our special ed class definitely had shame, to put it bluntly, about being in special ed. Like, we knew we were in special ed, and we would like hide it from people like who we hung out with who didn't go to our school. And did you feel any of that? Like, what was your mindset being in a special school?
Well, the thing is, because everyone else was in the same boat as me, and the people I connected with were all in that same situation, I didn't really feel any need to hide it. Back when I was in the other school, being special ed was a little awkward, but I'd already gotten that label anyway, so there wasn't really anything to do about it. And so, there wasn't really a problem, honestly.
So my brain is like, all my ticker tapes are running right now.
Stacey's trying to hit the unmute button. It's like stabbing, trying to get the thing to unmute.
Oh my gosh. I have like ticker tapes of like what I want to say. And so I have to pick one. But so I'm thinking in terms of like, you went to a school that specializes to help you with dyslexia strategies to be able to read. I'm old school. In terms of special education and teaching and how we used to do teaching.
So you believe in throwing kids in a broom closet?
But I remember when we had specialized schools and kids had their therapies every single day because all the therapists were housed in that school every single day. And then I remember them dispersing everyone and kids only got what they needed twice a week for 30 minutes, which didn't really pan out, right? Like, so I'm always thinking like, inclusion's great, But if you're not getting what you need, right? Like, what's the point, right? Because there are a lot of kids that are sitting in inclusive settings and they're not getting what they need. But everybody feels great that they're in an inclusive setting, right? But there's no one trained to be able to teach them the way they need to be taught. So what is your perspective on I'm not anti-inclusion. I am putting children where they're going to get what they need. I don't care where that is, the top of a cliff, the bottom of a cliff, if it's in the house, if it's outside, if it's in a big room, if it's in a small room, I don't really care, right? Wherever they're gonna get what they need. So what is your stance looking to now, right? Now he's a grown up in terms of, should schools have these programs built in? Is it better to have people who really want to do the work, who know how to do the work in one place so that they can go there? I don't know. I know this is not what our conversation is supposed to go to, but it's...
I think, honestly, I think, you know, there are different children need different things, I think. I think, first of all, each classroom is so big right now. There are too many kids in each classroom. There's no way that one teacher can address everybody in that classroom. And so they're just not going to be able to help, you know, anyone who doesn't fit into the mold. If they're at the top of the class or the bottom of the class, maybe, but in the middle, they just won't. And I think, you know, I don't always know what the answer is, but I honestly think that different children may need different things. I think that if there was a way to teach Orton Gillingham in the public school system, I personally think that would be amazing. I don't know how you would do it, but that again would need a specialist. And I think then if you pulled kids out to be able to teach them, then they could probably be included in the rest of the learning experience. But I think trying to get a child who can't read to just read the, you know, read the quote unquote normal ways, it's not gonna happen. And I think there is some need to pull kids out and without embarrassing them, without, you know, which is what happens a lot. But I'm not always sure how that works. And I think, like I said, I think for different issues, you might need different strategies.
And I gotta agree with that. I'm not qualified though to speak on that matter. I feel like it's a very complex one.
So we're gonna start bringing this in a little bit.
Great, because my computer is at 20% now.
Stacy's right now was on mute, just making a whole bunch of faces. I'm gonna get to that. Stacy, I know you have a couple other things to say, so I'll let.
I want to know, because I'm thinking about like what our listeners can benefit from in terms of your experience, Jonathan, when you said that you were in a place that got it right, like they knew what you needed, they supported what you needed, and you were able to get the strategies. How was it? Like,
it was great. I really had no. It was the right place for me, and that's It's where I needed to be. I made a lot of friends who I'm still in contact with, and it helped me learn a bunch of strategies that I still use today for other things. So yeah, no, it was great.
Also for Windward, just because that's our own experience, They take kids and they don't keep them for longer than they need to be there. They teach them, they give them the strategies, and then they make it so that, you know, the student can go back to a public school, a different private school, but they give them what each child needs. The classes are very small. And so there's a lot of individualized care, and every child leaves that school learning how to read and write on some level. Some better than others, just like anything else. But it's not a school that is meant to be a forever school.
Thank you.
And I just want to jump in and say, as great as that is to hear, I think the important thing for our listeners to understand is that despite your kids' struggles, you need to just don't send them to special ed, don't send them to Wynwood, just keep them in public school because that builds character. I was kept in regular school and none of my needs were met, and that built character, and I turned out just fine. So we have a running joke on this podcast where if someone says I turned out just fine, it means they did not in fact turn out just fine. I think it's great that he was able to find a school which helped his needs. And what Lynn says is important. It's not a forever school. It doesn't have to be forever. You can meet the child's needs, and maybe they need, maybe depending on what they have, they need support the rest of their life. Maybe they don't. But that can't be a concern. You have to be concerned with the child in the here and now and make sure they're getting their needs met. Because if they're not, it creates a whole bunch of issues, and they'll turn to me where they turned out, quote, just fine. So in my opinion, that is, for lack of a better word, a success story. And you love to hear it. You love to hear it.
I think anybody struggles makes them stronger, honestly.
Yes.
It's not the easy stuff we learn from. It's the hard stuff. So.
But we can have challenges with support.
Without traumatizing the kids.
Exactly.
Very true. Very
true. We don't have to make that struggle impossible.
Exactly.
We can do it with a cushion.
There was a principal years ago when he was being interviewed, because he did this like whole turnaround the school thing, and he grew up like poor and struggling. And so somebody said, oh, do you ever feel, because you know, he says, you know, growing up the way I grew up made me, you know, the person that I am. And he's like, but I'm not making my kids experience that so they can develop the character I develop. Like, no, nobody wants to be hungry, right? Like, I don't want that to be the way that my kids build character. But what I want to finish with is bringing back to the things that you guys said in terms of, it's not repeating a grade is going to make it better, right? Because I think that's always the answer. Let's just repeat it. Let's just do it again and again and again. Or making the kids read over and over and over again when it's like, okay, that's not working. Like, stop, right? Like, stop making them do it over and over and over again when it's not working. So I think for our listeners, you know, all of the things that you all said, I think should be little like flags or little like thoughts for them to consider, huh? Maybe my child is struggling. And I'm talking to listeners specifically, not because that just that they're autistic or ADHD, but maybe there is something else that we need to look at. And, you know, I think that this has been just a delight. Thank you all so much. And I'm so excited about the book. I will tell you, I am huge on books. I ordered the book this morning, sent it to two of my families. And once I get the book, I always do a video. And how do I say it, Torin? My families that follow me, I don't even know if follow is the right word. My little community, if I say buy a book, like, like I'm not Oprah. But my families are really good. And it's not even so much that I think families need to have this book. I have a lot of colleagues that are educators, a lot of colleagues that are librarians. This book needs to be in libraries. It needs to be in the schools. And this needs to be on the list of books that are read within the classroom, because it's important. It's really important. So
Stacey's the head of a small cult. So she basically wonderful. Says something.
We're on social media and we have a website. Both are Creative Cab Company. We would love to hear from anybody. DM us, email us, you know, find out, you know, we'd love if you have questions. So we really appreciate people's thoughts and comments, and we've been able to answer, you know, not that we're experts in the field, but we can give it our point of view. So thank you so much for having us. It's been wonderful. Problem.
And all those links will be in the description for the podcast. So
thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
I love that the character's a taxi driver, because a lot of kids don't know what a taxi is. You know, I'm from New Orleans, like taxi.
Wait, like, maybe we'll do a trolley next time.
I like taxi. I like kids learning about what a taxi is.
Well, we're in the process of writing another book, and it's going to be about ADHD. So we'll consider other characters as well.
I love that.
Indeed.
And Stacy, that's why we're working to
shift the narrative on everything autism and dyslexia
and everything else. See ya.